seems to know.
Okay,
I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. I'll lock my heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day. Moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'm close, and I'll see you with my heart.
Hi, I'm attorney Mari Frank, co-host of Privacy Piracy. How private is your confidential information? Who is watching you on surveillance cameras or listening in on your private phone conversations? Think of all the information you give up each day, from the fast track scans on the morning commute to the credit card purchases at Starbucks to your cell phone tracking, airline ticket, car rental records, and even the logging of PC keystrokes at work. These bits of data are shared with companies and the government to create a detailed dossier of your daily activities. How are your profiles used, and what can you do to protect yourself? We'll answer these questions and more when you listen to Privacy Piracy, Wednesday evenings from 5 to 6 p.m. at KUCI 88.9 FM or www.kuci.org.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Planetary Radio is Public Radio's only weekly series about space exploration. I'm Matt Kaplan, and I hope you'll join me as we explore Mars, look for life in the universe, and fly through the rings of Saturn. We'll talk with the men and women, scientists and dreamers who are guiding us to a future beyond Earth. And don't forget to enter our weekly space trivia contest. That's Planetary Radio, Mondays at 5:30 p.m. right here on KUCI.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And good morning and welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, California, streaming live on the web at kuci.org and podcasting through iTunes and at Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. At iTunes, simply click on the public radio page, scroll down to KUCI, And at Barbara's website, click on the radio tower on the left side of your screen, which will lead you to our radio page. And from there, you can download archives of past shows. For those of you who can't catch us live, this is a great way to ensure you don't miss out. I'm your host, Marie Stone. I'm in for Barbara this morning. We'll be back here next week, sharing the hosting chair once again. As always, Writers on Writing brings you live conversations with authors, poets, agents, publishers, anyone and everyone responsible for putting books onto our shelves, into our libraries, and into our lives. This morning, I'm joined by John Truby, and coming up in the second half hour, A.J. Jacobs will be here, so please stay with me for that. John Truby is one of the most respected and sought-after story consultants in the film industry, and his students have gone on to pen some of Hollywood's most successful films, including Sleepless in Seattle, Scream, and Shrek. The Anatomy of Story, 22 Steps to Becoming a Master Storyteller, is his long-awaited first book, and it shares all his secrets for writing a compelling script, novel, or story. John is Hollywood's premier story consultant and founder of Truby's Writer's Studio. He's worked as a story consultant and script doctor for Disney Studios, Sony Pictures, Fox, and HBO, among others, and has taught his 22-step great screenwriting and genre classes to more than 20,000 students worldwide. John, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here.
It's great to have you on. You know, I'm just curious, maybe we can start here, how you came to be a story and script consultant. Can you talk about your path into the industry?
Oh, absolutely. It's everybody has a different way that that somehow they're able to get through the gates to get into the industry. And for me, it was pretty much I was writing scripts and starting to network with other writers, and we'd give each other feedback. It really became a word-of-mouth thing where people would say, hey, talk to him, have him read your script, because he'll give you some good thoughts on what you need to do about it. And through that word of mouth, it's really within the industry, it's a fairly small world. And so I started doing work for some of the studios, and it just grew from there.
Mm. That's obviously a great tribute to your skill, because it's difficult to look at difficult to look at a story or a script and figure out where you know there's a problem, but finding out where the problem lies is a very defined and great skill.
Well, you know, it you're absolutely right about that, and because movies, especially Hollywood movies, put so much emphasis on structure, on architecture of the story, that's kind of where my expertise has always gone, and I've always had a feel for that, a knack for that, and so there becomes a high premium placed on that in the Hollywood world.
Yeah, there's so many poor movies made these days.
Yeah.
So let's delve in. There's so much to talk about here. And I want to start sort of at the beginning, because I think, you know, this lays the foundation for everything, your conversation on premise versus designing principle.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked your discussion on creating a designing principle for the work. The creation of premise was familiar, but the designing principle was kind of more amorphous, and this book did a wonderful job of defining it. Can you talk about the two concepts and how they differ and why the latter is so important?
Absolutely. It's a great question because so much of the success of the full story comes down to the premise, and the success of the premise depends so much on whether you have that designing principle or not. I'm sure you know, the premise is the writer's story stated in one line. An actor who can't get work dresses up as a woman, gets a job, and falls in love with one of the actresses on the show. That's a one-line premise for Tootsie. And premise is very important because 9 out of 10 writers fail at the premise. It's the core idea that the whole story will play out. And what most writers do is they come up with a premise that's not original. And because there is so much competition, there's estimated 100,000 scripts written a year and only 300 buyers. So there's a tremendous emphasis placed on having an original premise. Well, because premise work is so hard, and most writers don't realize how difficult it is, in my opinion, it's the most difficult step in the entire writing process, because you have almost nothing to work with at the level of premise. You have only that one-line idea. So this is where so many writers go wrong, and one of the main emphases that I place in the premise chapter is techniques to help writers flesh out that one-line idea so that you go from one line to an entire script or novel. Of those techniques, I believe the designing principle technique is the most important, and it's one that, amazingly enough to me, very few writers are aware of. The designing principle is the concept that organizes the story as the whole. It's the internal logic of the story. And incredibly enough, most stories don't have one. It's got to be something that's extremely unique that only your story has. And it's what really connects all the parts together and plays out the same basic idea from beginning to end of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm wondering, it seems like, or there's the notion that there's only, 10 stories in the universe, or, some people have even gone so far as to say there are two stories in the universe. So I'm wondering if the premise line, you're talking about how difficult it is to be original in the premise line, and I'm wondering if you buy into the fact that there are a defined kind of universe of stories that people tell, and perhaps the designing principle is the way to distinguish your premise from other similar premises, or am I off base?
Well, I've never really been a believer in the idea of reducing the number of stories down that far. What I think is more precise, a better way to look at it, is that we have these different genres of stories, different types of stories, and depending on who you talk to, they're anywhere from 10 or 15 major genres, but then up to really over 100 subgenres. These are different classifications of stories where, for example, we all know what a love story is, and certain things, certain beats are being accomplished in those in each unique genre. Mm. But what is required of a writer is that within that type of story, and especially if you're working in popular fiction and in mainstream Hollywood scripts, you have to be very aware of what genre you're working in. In fact, one of the biggest mistakes writers make at the premise line is they use the wrong genre to develop the idea, because mm-hmm. there are a number of genres that you could use when you come up with that one-line premise to help you execute that story and turn it into a full novel or script. But within that genre, you also have to be original. In other words, you have to put new skin on those bones. Mm-hmm. Because that's the only way that you set yourself apart from all the other writers working in that form. And I always tell people, be aware that you're not competing against all the other writers working out there. You're competing against the other writers working in your genre. And that's why you've got to take that story and put a twist on it. Do it in a way that hasn't ever been done before. And that's what makes it original. And that's what sets you apart from everybody else.
Mm, great advice. Great advice. I want to move on to character. There's, like I keep saying, there's so much to talk about. The best advice is to buy your book, because it's there's a lot in there. So you had some good advice on making your character fascinating. And one piece of advice you gave at the outset is to make your character mysterious by giving them a secret or something they're hiding from the audience.
Right.
And that will force the audience to engage with the character and find out what's being concealed.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the other elements necessary to creating an engaging main character?
Well, I mean, the one that you mentioned is one of the most important, and interestingly enough, it's something that most writers don't do, because they tend to go the other direction. Most writers give too much exposition in the story up front. They tell the audience and the reader too much about this character in the beginning part of the story. And that's why I talk about it being so important to hold off certain very important information, because this will provide a reveal, a surprise to the audience later on. And it also gets the audience to want to find out more. In other words, you're literally getting them to do some of the work of the storytelling. You're getting them engaged. They're coming to your story instead of you telling them everything and having them sit back passively. And typically what this element is that you hide is a story concept that I use called the ghost. This is an event from the past that is still haunting the character in the present. And almost all main characters have some kind of a ghost that happened previously. And we typically want to hide that for at least the first third of the story, because this is one of the things that the audience and the other characters can dig down into the main character and find out about. Now, there's as you mentioned, there's a number of other techniques that you can use. What a lot of writers do, I think incorrectly, is when they're trying to flesh out a character, they try to come up with as many character traits about that person as possible, as though just by simple addition you can get to know who this character is. But the problem with that technique is that those are all superficial traits. And audiences are not interested in superficial things. Audiences are interested in only the essentials about the character. And that's why I put so much emphasis in the character section on the first two of the seven major story structure steps. And those first two steps are the need of the character and the desire of the character. And so much of storytelling turns on these two key elements in a character and how they differ and how they come into conflict.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I think in Writing 101, we talk about needing to know what the character wants, and the novel is driven by what he wants. And I hadn't really focused on distinguishing that from what the character needs.
Correct.
And perhaps that's one of the pitfalls most writers fall into.
It is. It's one of the biggest mistakes, and it's a disaster if you make that mistake. Most writers don't realize that there are two key steps that open the story. And if you think there's only one, or if you confuse them and are not clear about the difference for your character, you've blown the foundation of the story. Everything sits on top of these two key elements. And of course, the difference is crucial. What the character wants is the particular goal that they go after over the course of the story, and it's very important because the audience really connects to that. If the hero wants it, the audience wants it. And so I always talk about desire is the train that everybody gets on, and they go after the goal at the end of the tracks. But what many writers don't realize is that the more important step is the need step, which comes just before desire in the story. This is what the character must get in order to have a better life. And it's based on, typically, on some, at least one great weakness that is destroying their lives at the beginning and preventing them from having the kind of life they should.
Okay. Interesting. One other thing that I want to talk to you about characters is your concept of the character web, and how so many writers kind of throw a lot of people onto the stage and think about them as individuals rather than how they're interacting and influencing each other.
Right.
And to rectify that problem, you talk about creating these character webs. Can you talk about that for just a second?
Absolutely. It's in my opinion, the biggest mistake that writers make in the character area. I just talked about the distinction between need and desire, which is a big one, but this is even bigger. And it's because most writers tend to think of their characters as unique individuals. And it makes sense that you would do that, because you want to have very unique characters. And you don't want to essentially have everybody in your book or your script be the same person, of course. But the problem with that approach to how you write the story is that it prevents people from seeing that each of these characters is actually defining the other characters. Because in a story, we have relatively little time to do a tremendous amount of material that we have to do, not only defining all the characters, laying out the plot, the theme, the dialogue, and so on. So one of the most important techniques for defining character is in relation to the other characters. And there's various ways that I talk about in the character chapter that you create your character web so that each of the characters helps to define and distinguish each of the other characters. And the reason this is so important is that this is the primary way that you create a strong main character. And it's also the primary way that you make sure that the minor characters are not cardboard characters, but instead give the appearance of being a complete person.
And the last thing I want to touch on before we leave character is another mistake that that I'm certainly guilty of, which is, you know, we know that our main character needs to go through some sort of arc or change over the course of the novel. And I think a lot of people think about that at the end. if I get to the end and nothing's happened, I'll fix it in the last 30 pages. But you talk about having to deal with that right at the beginning so that your setup is in place for the change to occur over the course of the novel.
It's absolutely it may be the most important technique that I talk about in the book, because it is a technique that is useful not only for character but also for plot and theme. And the problem that you just described is a problem that so many writers have, which is they'll tell the story and then they'll think that, oh, I'm going to have this character change in the last scene. I call this the light switch school of character change. You just flip a switch at the end and somehow they're a different person. Well, character change does not work that way. And if you write the story thinking that you'll figure out that change at the end, it will never happen. And so I talk about some of the techniques that you can use to make sure that that character change is embedded in the story, because really the entire story, all of the plot, should sit on top of that character arc. And so you say, well, how do you do that? How do you make that connection between character and plot? And one of the ways that you do it that I talk about in the character chapter is we start at the end point of the character change and then go to the very beginning of the character change. And then the reason that's so important is because what I've just lined out there is essentially a journey that the character takes. In any good story, the character is going to go on a journey of learning from beginning to end. And they may go on an actual journey, but they're very definitely going on a journey of learning. Mm-hmm. But in any journey that you take, you have to know the end point of where you're going in order to take the first step and every step thereafter. And so that's why I say it's so important to start with the end point of the character change, then go back to the beginning of the story, to the setup of the character change. And that setup will essentially be what it will be the character's weakness. It will be what the character doesn't know about who they are that will make them, give them a better life, make them a better person.
Interesting. I'll remind our listeners, I'm talking with John Truby, author of The Anatomy of Story, 22 Steps to Becoming a Master Storyteller. Maybe I'll interject this question here. It seems like we have a lot of guests on the show, and the question is often, how much did you know when you began writing the story? And the answer is more often virtually nothing. You know, I sat down and through the writing process, I discovered my character and I discovered my story, and it turned out to be something completely different than what I thought it was going to be at the beginning. And I gather that's absolutely the opposite of what you're advocating here.
Well, it may be a difference in terms of just the way we're talking about it, because I talk in the book in the premise section about when you first start off with that story idea, you don't know anything. You really are in the dark at that point. And what you do is you go through these various techniques and process of finding out what that story's about. And that's really what this book is about. It's filled with all the techniques that you can use to help you figure out, first of all, what makes your story original, because you absolutely have to start with that. But then once you figure out what is about my story that's original, then you have to figure out, well, what are the techniques for fleshing this out to a full-length novel that will be able to execute this original idea. And the writers that you have on the show, I'm sure, have various techniques that they use to do that. What I've tried to do in this book is to put down all the techniques in each of the major story skills that you can use to come up with a really well-executed original story. And that's why each of the chapters is based on a different major story skills. So, for example, we've got a chapter on premise and character, plot, moral argument, symbol, dialogue, and so on. Because what I wanted to do was give writers a series of steps from beginning to end that they could work through to flesh out their story, but also because I don't want to impose my process on them. Each writer has a unique process, so you can come at the book and from really whatever direction works best for you as a writer. Some people think best and start off best with the world of the story. Others start with character, others start with premise. And so what I encourage people to do is to approach the book and read the book in the same way that they would flesh out their story.
And I suppose you can do that as you're writing it, too. It's probably just more back-end work on the revision.
Exactly.
Process. Yeah.
Exactly. And the revision is so important. Most writers don't know the importance of rewriting, but they don't realize that rewriting is an important major skill itself, and that there are certain ways to rewrite that are better than others. Because a common problem that writers have, although very few people want to admit it, which is that for most writers, their second draft is worse than their first. And this is one of the most depressing things in writing, and it's one reason that so many writers give up. And that comes from the fact that they don't realize that there are certain steps in rewriting, matching the techniques that I talk about in the book, that you need to work through in order to actually come up with a better draft on each successive time.
I like it. I took the Robert McKee story seminar probably, I don't know, 5 years ago in New York, and there's some familiar underpinnings here, and there's some not so familiar ones. On what areas do you agree with him on his approach, and in what ways do your approaches differ?
Well, I don't know his approach. I've never read his book. I've never taken his class. I came at the storytelling process from a very different position than most people. In college, I was a philosophy major, and so I used, when I got out of college and I wanted to tell stories of my own, this was before there were any books on the subject, and really very few courses in college that you could take. And so I used the approach that Aristotle used, which is I went to actual stories and tried to figure out what made them work and where they didn't work and why. And so I, for 3 years, sat in a theater watching two movies a day, classic films a day, and taking notes. And really went at it, because I didn't want to impose a theory of story onto the storytelling process, because that was bound to be false, and that was just bound to be too theoretical. So I went the other direction, and I just looked at the best films, the best novels that I could find, tried to find out what the patterns were. And that's essentially what is in this book. It's all of the techniques from looking at master storytellers. How did they do it? And these are the techniques. And what I try to do is pull them out, draw them out, and make them very specific and very clear. Because so often I find when people talk about story, they write a book on story, or they write a book on screenwriting or novel writing, it's a lot of hot air, basically. It's a lot of theoretical language. And when it comes down to writing, as any writer will admit, you're facing the blank page. You need some very specific techniques if you're going to really bring your story idea to life. And so that's why I tried to make these techniques in the book so specific so that anybody could use them and learn them and master them.
Wonderful. Yeah, and one thing that I should mention is the book is full of wonderful examples where you've applied each of the premises that you're talking about to a movie and or to a novel, and showing it exactly at work. There are a couple of movies that get a lot of play: The Godfather, Casablanca, and I'm wondering as we close out here, if you can talk about as writers watch movies or read novels, are there techniques that they can use while they're engaged in other people's stories to allow them to sort of see behind the curtain a little bit?
That's a great question, and there is what I always recommend that people do. It's chapter 3 of the book called the 7 major story structure steps. And these are the 7 most important structure steps in any story. They are organic to the story, meaning they're in your story right now. And what you have to do is spot them, pull them out, and make them say what you want them to say. Whenever you're looking at another book or another film, short story, it doesn't matter what the medium or the genre is, apply those 7 steps, and you will see 70 to 80% of what is working in that piece of fiction and what is not working. In the plot chapter, I go through the much fuller and more detailed 22 steps of every great story. But the 7 steps are the easiest way to break down another story, to see what that storyteller, what the main techniques that person is using, and whether they worked or didn't.
Great stuff. Great stuff. And unfortunately, we're out of time, but we didn't even cover plot in a story. there are about 10 chapters we didn't even get to touch upon. But this was just wonderful advice, John.
Well,
thanks so much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And for me too. That was John Truby, author of The Anatomy of Story: 22 Steps to Becoming a Master Storyteller. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I'll be joined by AJ Jacobs. So please stay tuned. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like 1,000 years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, Arden.
So, we should get a promo for our show.
Yeah, that might be a good idea.
But it has to be clever.
What should we do?
I don't know. I'm not that clever, man.
Me either.
All right, well, our show's on Saturdays from 2 to 4 p.m.
Yeah.
And yeah. Okay.
And we have lots of live bands.
I guess that wasn't that clever. Oh, well.
Too bad we weren't recording this.
And you're listening to Peace and Unity.
And your mom.
Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
What is this profession called coaching? What is a coach? No, not football, not soccer, not even tennis. By now, you must have heard the terms life coaching or executive coaching or even business coaching. Come find out on Coaching Conversations with me, Patricia Hirsch, where I interview coaches from around the world, mainly from the 12,000-plus membership of the International Coach Federation, where coaches are becoming certified. Coaching Conversations with Patricia Hirsch, alternate Fridays at 9 a.m. on KUCI 88.9 FM Irvine. Find out more on the show's website at www.patriciahirsch.com. That's PatriciaHirsch.com.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at KUCI.org or check out the latest program guide.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming live on the web at KUCI.org. And as I mentioned earlier, this show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit penonfire.com for more details on that. Again, I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara this week. A.J. Jacobs is the editor-at-large of Esquire. He is the author of America Offline and My Outsourced Life for Esquire and editor of What It Feels Like, in addition to being the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Know-It-All. He's contributed to the New York Times, New York Magazine, and NPR's Weekend Edition, among others. His latest memoir is The Year of Living Biblically, One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Bible as Literally as Possible. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and he joins us now from New York. AJ, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Marie. Great to be here.
This is fun. I have to tell you, I read this book in nearly one sitting, perhaps two sittings, because I'm a slow reader, but it's written in your classic style. It's laugh out loud funny and engaging, but it's also a good primer full of, you know, fabulous biblical information for agnostics like me. So that was
well, that's great. Thank you.
Great.
You're giving me the sin of pride. I'm giving you the sin of pride now.
So let's begin with the book. Perhaps talk just for a minute about what the book is about, what it encompasses, and how you got the idea.
Yeah, sure. I got the idea because I grew up with no religion at all. As I say in the book, I'm Jewish in the same way the Olive Garden is Italian. So not very. But I've become very interested in religion. I think it's a huge defining issue of our time. I had a son. I wanted to know what to teach him. So I decided to dive in head first, because that's the way I like to tackle a topic. So for my previous book, I read the Encyclopedia Britannica from A to Z in my attempt to learn what's the meaning of knowledge and the difference between facts and wisdom. So and this one, I decided to actually live the Bible. So I went and wrote down every rule I could find in the Bible, from the famous ones like the Ten Commandments and love thy neighbor and be fruitful and multiply, to the ones that we don't hear about so much, like don't shave your beard. So I had this huge appendage on my chin by the end. Don't wear clothes made of mixed fiber. So I had these, I got rid of all my poly cotton T-shirts, right on down to stoning adulterers.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. How did you, was it difficult to define the scope of the project? You did, the last 3 months you did the New Testament. Are there other things that posed problems, in, you know, different interpretations or things that weren't so clear? And how did you go about defining the scope of how you would approach it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it was a massive undertaking, and I knew I needed as much help as I could get. So I did assemble a board of spiritual advisors. So I had rabbis and priests and ministers and atheists and all these, and scholars and people advising me on how to interpret the Bible, because of course you know, the interpretations vary so dramatically, and I thought maybe I could strip away all these hundreds of years of interpretation and get back to what the Bible really says, sort of like what Scalia tries to do with the Constitution. And of course I discovered this is impossible. You can't get to the original, because it's too slippery, it was too long ago. So there's always a matter of interpretation, and I learned that that's okay, you know, as long as the interpretation focuses on the right things, uh-huh. compassion and loving your neighbor, instead of, for instance, you know, that homosexuality is a sin, for instance.
Right. And can you talk about, there was an enormous amount of preparation you did for this, enormous amount of reading, which I guess you're not afraid of after the Encyclopedia Project.
That's true. Well, I did. I read the Bible, which I had never done in the first place, and it was an amazing experience in that alone. I mean, just Genesis was so full of these stories that are complex and have these complex characters, like King David, who, you know, commits adultery, and you know, they're not flawless heroes. They're really real human heroes that you can relate to. So I loved reading it. But then I also read dozens of books of biblical interpretation.
Yeah. What a massive project. I'm still trying to wrap my brain around how you would how you'd approach something this old and this intricate in a year. It's just astonishing.
I could have done it for 20 years. But,
I mean,
it was massive in the sense that it was like an extreme makeover, in that it changed every part of my life, the way I ate, the way I talked, the way I thought, the way I hugged my wife. So every single part of my life was affected, not just my crazy beard. And by the end, incidentally, I was trying to dress in a biblical way. So I was wearing, at the very end, sandals and robes, and sort of, even in New York, where I live, this caused people to take a second look, perhaps cross the street to avoid me.
Yeah, that brings up a good point, which is setting this in New York, which is an obvious place to set it, because that's, you know, that's where you live. But New York is, you know, it's very funny and obviously just a great setting for this. You know, there are a lot of,
like, the modern day Sodom and Gomorrah. So
yeah,
it's,
exactly.
You know, I mean, part of the year was trying not to covet and lie and gossip. So imagine trying to do this in New York. That's pretty much all we do.
That's the definition of New York, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. I had nothing left to do. So, that was fascinating. And actually, this was interesting. I never knew there is an Orthodox Jewish gossip hotline, because I was always tempted to gossip, because you don't realize how much we gossip and lie and covet until you really start to pay attention. But you can call this hotline, which is like a suicide hotline but for gossip, and they'll talk you down. If you have the urge to gossip, they'll talk you down from the ledge. So that was wonderful. I use them quite a bit.
Do they engage with gossip with you?
No, they were very good. I tried to tempt them, but they wouldn't do it.
Great. Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, that's the flip side of setting it in New York. There's so many opportunities for the bad, but there were also opportunities for the good. There were, like you just mentioned, this odd place, and there were places where you can, you know, sacrifice a chicken, and there was something for everybody in New York. And I'm wondering how this project may have differed, do you think, if you lived in Iowa or someplace else?
Well, that's true. It is. You have just the whole buffet of religion represented in New York. Even though we think of it as a secular city, there's the Hasidic Jews and there are evangelical Christians, and so it was nice that I got to experience all of them because I did want to visit and embed myself with these various spiritual communities because I wanted to see how they interpreted the Bible, and I was able to learn so much from them, so much wisdom from them, and I spent a lot of time with all sorts. And I'm very proud because I think I might be the first person in America to out Bible talk a Jehovah's Witness. He came over to my house, and after 3.5 hours, he looked at his watch. He says, "I gotta go." So it was, but I was just very enthusiastic about the topic. It's such a fascinating topic.
And this was a man you had to call over.
That's true. They were very confused because in New York they don't actually ring the doorbells because I guess I'm not sure why, it may be too dangerous. But they so I had to call and request, and they had never experienced that. They didn't know how to handle that. I had to call about 5 or 6 different people before I finally got one who would send me a Jehovah's Witness over.
That's fabulous. That's fabulous. I'm talking with A.J. Jacobs, author of The Year of Living Biblically, One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Bible as Literally as Possible. What was the strangest experience you had during this year?
Well, there were quite a few. There was, I went to the Creationist Museum in Kentucky, which was fascinating because this is a worldview that is completely the opposite to mine. I'm very much an evolutionist. So it was really interesting. And one thing was that they were very smart, and if I had to wager, I'd say there's no difference in the average IQ of a creationist and someone who believes in evolution. It's just I believe that the creationists' faith is so strong that they'll distort the scientific data to fit their literal 6-day creation, which I don't think is necessary. I think you can still find meaning and beauty in the Bible without following every word, interpreting every word literally. So, which was part of the reason why I chose the approach I did, to show that you don't have to take it all literally. There's so much metaphor and poetry and beauty in there. But anyway, it was very strange to, you know, talk to these people and learn how their worldview is so radically different.
That's amazing. I love listening to the background noise in New York there with and being reminded of
construction. I'm sorry about that.
No, it's fabulous because it's this great juxtaposition of, you know, picturing you in your apartment building a hut and and all of this background, you know, the life of New York going on around you.
Well, that was actually noisy because I had to do some hammering. Yeah, that is, once a year the Bible instructs us to build a hut so we can remember what our forefathers, how they lived in the desert. And I couldn't get permission to build it on the sidewalk, so I built it in our living room. So, and my wife did not appreciate the construction project in our living room.
I can imagine that. I do want to talk about your wife and her role in this in just a minute, but I might have you read to us now, if you don't mind, and then people can get kind of a sense for your voice and what you went through here.
Sure, I'd be honored. As I write this here, I thought I'd just read a couple of passages from the introduction, which we talked a little bit about my motivation, but as I write this, I have a beard that makes me resemble Moses, or Abe Lincoln, or Ted Kaczynski. I've been called all three. It's not a well-manicured, socially acceptable beard. It's an untamed mass that creeps up toward my eyeballs and drapes below my neckline. I've never allowed my facial hair to grow before, and it's been an odd and enlightening experience. I've been inducted into a secret fraternity of bearded guys. We nod at each other as we pass on the street, giving a knowing quarter smile. Strangers have come up to me and petted my beard like it's a Labrador Retriever puppy or a pregnant woman's stomach. And it's upset people. Thus far, 2 little girls have burst into tears, and 1 boy has hidden behind his mother. But I mean no harm. The facial hair is simply the most noticeable physical manifestation of a spiritual journey I began a year ago. My quest has been this, to live the ultimate biblical life, or more precisely, to follow the Bible as literally as possible, to obey the Ten Commandments, to be fruitful and multiply, to love my neighbor, to tithe my income, but also to abide by the often neglected rules, to avoid wearing clothes of mixed fibers, to stone adulterers, and naturally, to leave the edges of my beard unshaven, as instructed by Leviticus 19:27. I'm trying to obey the entire Bible without picking and choosing. To back up, I grew up in an extremely secular home in New York City. I'm officially Jewish, but I'm Jewish in the same way the Olive Garden is an Italian restaurant. Not very. I attended no Hebrew school, ate no matzah. The closest my family came to observing Judaism was that paradoxical classic of assimilation, A Star of David on top of our Christmas tree. It's not that my parents badmouthed religion, it's just that religion wasn't for us. We lived in the 20th century, for crying out loud. In our house, spirituality was almost a taboo subject, much like my father's salary or my sister's clove cigarette habit. Should I go on, or is that...
That's fabulous, that's fabulous. That was A.J. Jacobs reading from his latest novel, memoir, The Year of Living Biblically. You mentioned the adultery and stoning adulterers, and I have to tell you, I almost fell out of my chair laughing, and I've showed that passage to everybody I know. perhaps you could just share that story, because it really is one of my favorites.
Ah, well, thank you, Marie. Yeah, it was, it's a huge part of the Old Testament, stoning and capital punishment, so I felt I had to obey it in some way. So what happened was, I was in the park, and I was sort of dressed in my biblical garb, the sandals and the white clothes, and a man came up to me, and he said, why are you dressed like that? And I explained my project. I'm trying to follow Ten Commandments, stoning adulterers. He says, well, I'm an adulterer. Are you going to stone me? And I said, well, yes, that would be great. And I took out a pocket full of stones that I had been carrying around for just this occasion, because I had been hoping for this interaction. And the stones, by the way, were small. They were pebbles, because it didn't say the size of the stones in the Bible, so this was my loophole. And he was a very aggressive adulterer. He was an elderly man, mid-70s, but still an adulterer. So he grabbed the stones out of my hand and threw them at my face, and I was stunned. But I felt that an eye for an eye, I could toss one back at him. So that was my way of stoning. But it did allow me to talk about some of the bigger issues that this brings up. For instance, how can the Bible be so wise and compassionate in some parts and yet so seemingly barbaric in others? So this is sort of a way to talk about that. And I talked to my spiritual advisors and wrote about what they had to say.
Yeah. Yeah. How well do you feel you know the Bible, having come through this? I mean, obviously, you read it and you lived it, but given there are the thousands of years before this of people doing that, how well do you feel you got your arms around the project?
Well, I certainly cannot quote it chapter and verse. I have a cousin who is an Orthodox Jew who is just astounding. You say Leviticus 14:2, and he'll say what it is. But I feel that I really did get a good sense of it. And also I feel I learned a lot about the Bible that they don't necessarily teach in Sunday school, because there's such beautiful stuff in the Bible, but then there's also stuff that that doesn't get a lot of play because it is so odd and almost off-putting. Something like the fact that you cannot touch women during certain times of the month. But more than that, you cannot sit on a seat where a woman in her time of month has sat, according to Leviticus. And my wife thought this was offensive, so she sat in every seat in our apartment, and I had to stand for much of the year.
That brings up your wife's role in the project, because, the project is so huge and all-encompassing, and like you said, it changed the way you did absolutely everything. And I thought many times of her while I was reading this, and I was wondering if you had big conversations with her before this started, and how it would impact your lives, and kind of how she lived through this with you.
Yeah, I don't think she knew quite how much it would. I don't think either of us knew how much it would impact our lives, and actually how much lasting impact it would have on me and my beliefs. So the one thing she was excited about was that she thought that this would help me appreciate the good parts of religion, which it did, because she's slightly more religious than me, and she thought, well, here's a way for him to learn some of the wisdom, and that did turn out to be true, but I don't think either of us anticipated things like her sitting on every seat in the apartment, or building a hut, or the fact that I couldn't gossip, which drove her crazy, or the fact that I couldn't lie, so I had to, when one of her acquaintances asked us if, said, oh, it's great to see you, we should have a play date with our kids, and I said, well, you seem nice, but I have so many friends that I don't see, that I'm not sure I'm ready to take on any new friends, and that was extremely awkward.
Yeah.
That was not something that my wife enjoyed.
To say the least, I'm sure.
Right.
I'm curious about kind of the lessons of time and distance, and now that you've been away from the project for a period of time, do you think about it differently than when you were in it, and are there things that perhaps you regret having done or not having done, and has time away from it kind of given you a new perspective or anything that happened during that year?
It has. The main thing, I don't regret much because it was the most fascinating year of my life and the most life-changing as well. And I started out as an agnostic, and by the end of the year I became what a minister friend of mine called a reverent agnostic.
Mm.
Which is whether or not there's a God. I believe in the importance of sacredness and that the Sabbath can be sacred, for instance, or even prayers or meditation or whatever you want to call it, that can be sacred. So it definitely changed me. And if I had to do one thing over again, it was I spent most of my time on the Old Testament, and I explored the New Testament, but only for 4 months because basically I ran out of time. So I don't know. Maybe I would have done the 2 years of living biblically or something, but it was just too much material to cover.
I mean, yeah, right. We're drawing down on the clock, but I'm wondering if I missed any big chunks that you want to share in the end, or anything you gleaned from this process that maybe we didn't touch on.
Well, one thing is gratefulness. This also changed my life in that I was saying all these prayers of thanksgiving, which, by the way, was a little odd since I was an agnostic. So saying the whole prayer part of this was fascinating, and I did grow to love some kinds of prayer. But anyway, saying these prayers of thanksgiving, it really changed my perspective radically because I started to be thankful for all the little things that were going right every day. Because there are hundreds of things that go right every day that we never acknowledge, and we always focus, always focus on the three or four that go wrong. So having this mindset where you're thankful for the fact that, this phone didn't electrocute me, that the subway I took here wasn't stuck in the tunnel for 4 hours. So just becoming appreciative and not taking things for granted, that had a huge impact on me.
Yeah, and that's great, and that's good advice for life in general. Yeah. AJ, thanks so much for taking the time this morning.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Huge fun. That was A.J. Jacobs, author of The Year of Living Biblically, One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Bible as Literally as Possible, available now and published by Simon & Schuster. Our quote this morning comes from Jessamine West, who said, "Writing is a solitary occupation. Family, friends, and society are the natural enemies of the writer. He must be alone, uninterrupted, and slightly savage if he is to sustain and complete an undertaking." Barbara and I will be back with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. when we'll be joined by Percival Everett and T.J. Parcell. Be sure and tune in. And until next time, thanks for joining me. Have a great day.